Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... We have a jam-packed show for you this week, listener, as we focus our attention on violence in Jerusalem, negotiations over a new government, and a seemingly arbitrary decision to deport 70 members of the Black Hebrew Israelite community. In a little while, we'll be joined by Chaim Levinson, followed by Judy Maltz, but first up, Haaretz's Jerusalem correspondent, Nir Chasson. Nir, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm fine. Thank you, Simon.
So, Nir, what's been happening in Jerusalem? We hear headlines, hundreds arrested, scores wounded. What's going on?
Well, in the last 3 days, we see like a wave of violence in East Jerusalem that we didn't saw, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years. About 300 people were injured, about 25 or 30 policemen as well. And there are clashes between Palestinians and the police, mostly around Temple Mount, the Old City, the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. And the thing is that tomorrow is the Jerusalem Day, so things can probably be continue for tomorrow as well. And this is where many people here in Jerusalem.
This has been bubbling up for days, weeks, even years, right? And you wrote over the weekend that there's no single cause for the disturbances. What are the root causes here? You mentioned, again, Sheikh Jarrah, where the Israeli government is seeking to evict Palestinian families.
No, it's not the Israeli government. It's actually private right-wing NGOs who tried to evacuate about 300 Palestinian residents from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah. Well, as you say, no one can put a finger on one cause for what we saw in Jerusalem, what we see in Jerusalem in the last few days. It started about in the beginning of Ramadan, about 4 weeks ago. And many of the Palestinians will say that what started all of it is the police decision to close the Damascus Gate Square from sitting on the stairs. You have to understand that Damascus Gate is like the most important public square of East Jerusalem, and especially in the Ramadan, in the evenings of Ramadan. The police decided on the first day of Ramadan to put the barriers that people cannot sit there. And this was many Palestinians in Jerusalem considered as a provocation from the Israeli police. And it started the clashes over there in Damascus Gate. Later on, the story of the evacuation of the Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah started to be very important in the discourse, in the social networks and in the street. Another, I think, important factor is the involved of Israeli Arabs. Arabs from Umm al-Fahem, from Nazareth, from northern Israel, in the clashes in Jerusalem. They came every evening, many buses, to end the feast of Ramadan here in Jerusalem, and later on take part in the clashes, in the demonstrations against the police. And this is very interesting. This is something that I don't remember seeing before.
Police prevented the Palestinian citizens of Israel from reaching Jerusalem on Saturday, right? Leading to claims that Israel's not upholding its commitment to allow freedom of worship for all faiths. Do we know who decided to erect the roadblocks on the main highway to the capital?
Well, I don't know. It's someone from the police. I don't know his name, but it's a very good example for how the police act in Jerusalem. They decided to block the buses on the road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And the effect was that the people just left the buses and start walking to the city. And the next thing that happened was that all the road was blocked. And we saw some clashes in road number one, right? The main road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Mm. And the only thing that the police achieved in that act was to excavate the violence far away from the old city of Jerusalem and to make the people on the buses, hundreds of them, much more angry and frustrated from the way the police act. And they came to Jerusalem even more angry on how they feel about Jerusalem. So yeah, it's a good example of what the police shouldn't do, in my point of view, in those days in Jerusalem.
Mm. They've also provided examples of how not to behave in their handling of the disturbances themselves, right? Our colleague Amos Harel wrote this morning that police are displaying shockingly bad judgment, and you wrote that they're fanning the flames.
Right. I believe that the police made a few mistakes, especially around the way they treat the Palestinian public in Jerusalem. They do not understand the importance of those evenings of the Ramadan, the sensitivity of the Temple Mount and the Old City. They do not take under consideration the humiliation by using what we call in Hebrew the machtazit, the bo'esh. It's a water tank that shoots gallons of stinky water on the crowd. And I cannot think on anything that can destroy the holy days of Ramadan more than those stinky water. So I think that the police act very bad and without the sensibility that we should accept from the Jerusalem police.
The last few days, Neil, the social media networks have been full of videos of Israeli forces inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, walking on the prayer mats with their shoes on, dispersing the crowd there. This is going to inflame not only the Palestinian and Israeli Arab public opinion, but across the Muslim world, right?
It could. You must notice that they didn't went into the main Al-Aqsa Mosque in Temple Mount, but to the other smallest and less important buildings there. However, yeah, I think the last time that Israeli force went into Temple Mount in such force was 2017. And it should, and we heard some voices from Jordan, from the Emirates, from other Muslim states. It will recruit the Muslim all around the world, I guess. But it's very important what will happen today and tomorrow around the Jerusalem Day event, how Israel will act and how the Arab world will see it.
Mm. For our listeners who might not know, Jerusalem Day, which is celebrated tomorrow, right, marks 54 years since the capture or reunification of East and West Jerusalem during the Six-Day War.
Right.
I understand that the police and the military brass have recommended that tens of thousands of Jewish nationalists not be allowed to march through the old city.
Yes, but my guess that they will allow. They will allow them. Mm. I remember from last year, we had some tense period around Jerusalem Day, and they will let them go. It's like a symbol that they must go through. We're talking about tens of thousands of Jewish religious Zionists who walk through the Muslim quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. My guess, they will let them go. What the police says was that they will cross the Muslim neighborhood, but the parade will end until the end of the fast of Ramadan, meaning about 7:30 in the evening. So there will be no clashes between Palestinians and the Jews. However, I don't see the police refuse the parade to go through there.
Mm, even if it is very, very provocative and could lead to violence.
Yeah, I get this is my guess. They may not allow Jewish activists went on Temple Mount tomorrow morning. Though this decision didn't take it yet, they will decide it tomorrow very early in the morning. Mm. And they may not let them go on Temple Mount. But the main event of Jerusalem Day, the flag parade that go through the Muslim quarter, will, my guess, they will go.
So I understand that also tomorrow, perhaps not coincidentally, there is meant to be a Supreme Court hearing,
right,
petition against the eviction of these families.
Right.
Is Netanyahu reportedly is trying to get that postponed. Will that go ahead?
I'm not sure that Netanyahu really tried to postpone it. We are waiting for the decision from the government, from the Ministry of Justice, if they are going to come to the court tomorrow and ask to be part of it. Because you have to understand that the hearing is between the Palestinian residents and the right-wing NGOs. The government, the state, is not part of the process. So the state have to decide if they want to be part of it because of national security reasons or the diplomatic factors. Anyway, we will know very soon if they are going to come tomorrow and what they're going to say to the court. But the important thing about Sheikh Jarrah is that the cause that those right-wing activists can come and ask the Palestinians to evacuate from the house is that the land of Sheikh Jarrah used to belong to Jewish hand before 48. And what the Palestinians say, okay, if we are open the case of 48, so let us get our property from West Jerusalem, from Jaffa, Lydia, Haifa, all over Israel. We have property from before 48. Why only Jews can ask for their property? And that claim is a very strong claim, not in the Israeli court, because the Israeli law is very clear about it, that the Palestinians cannot get their property back.
Mm.
However, in the diplomatic, in the mind of the Palestinians, this is a very strong case. It's a very strong reason why going on this battle.
Mm.
That's why Sheikh Jarrah is so emotional. It's part of the reason that Jerusalem is so violent in these days.
Mm. The foreign ministry in Jerusalem tweeted that the PA and Palestinian terror groups are presenting a real estate dispute between private parties as a nationalistic cause in order to incite violence in Jerusalem. That strikes me as willfully disingenuous. I mean, the government has been encouraging these right-wing NGOs in various ways, correct?
They are not only encouraging them, and they have a political support in the right-wing parties in Israel. I just heard that tomorrow Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are going to go for a tour in Sheikh Jarrah, but all the Israeli legal system made it possible for those right-wing activists to put a claim on the Palestinian property.
Mm.
So now coming and saying, okay, we are not part of it, it makes no sense.
Mm. Because only Palestinian property can be absentee property according to Israeli law.
Exactly. Mm. All the Palestinian property that were left during the War of Independence is belong to the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they cannot claim it anymore. But the Jewish property that were abandoned in the same time, in the same days, can be asked from the those right-wing to get it back to the Jewish hand.
Mm. So there has been a lot of international comment, not just, as you mentioned, from Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, for example. The United Nations expressed its dismay and deep concern. The Mideast Quartet said it was alarmed and that it's closely monitoring the situation.
Right.
Even Elizabeth Warren tweeted that the forced removal of longtime Palestinian residents is abhorrent and unacceptable. Is the government, such as we have, going to face a lot of international pressure in the coming days?
We don't have a government in Israel. I mean, we really, the political system in Israel, there's no one there. I don't think the Prime Minister Netanyahu is dealing with the issue of Sheikh Jarrah in these days. He's mostly dealing with the political issues of how can he stay at the Prime Minister House.
Mm. He did find time to issue a brief statement that he'll not allow any extremist element to undermine peace in Jerusalem, and rather ironically said that we will continue to safeguard freedom of worship for all religions, which is kind of ironic given yesterday's events on Highway 1.
Can't agree more. Right.
So, Nir, you obviously have a very busy day tomorrow with Jerusalem Day. Is it going to keep you busy from the early morning until after sunset?
I guess so, yes. We have the Supreme Court hearing and then the prayer and so many events around, all day long.
Let's hope that it passes off quietly and that we don't see your byline on the front page of tomorrow's newspaper, Nir.
Oh, amen to that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome, Simon. Thank you.
Listener, stay tuned. Coming up, we've got Chaim Levinson after this jingle. Welcome back, listener, and welcome to Chaim Levinson. How are you, Chaim?
Amazing. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for asking. So, Chaim, we've just heard from Nir Hassan about the unrest in Jerusalem, but all that is going on against the backdrop of intense coalition negotiations between Yesh Atid chairman Yair Lapid, who has until mid-June, if I'm not mistaken, to form a government, and leaders of pretty much every other party in the Knesset. So what's currently preventing Lapid from forming a coalition?
I don't think it will be mid-June. It will be the beginning of June. What's preventing? First of all, I don't think something is preventing. And second of all, look, to form a coalition, a very weird coalition, even with all the incentive to finish it fast in order to send Netanyahu home maybe this week or even next week, it's a complicated issue. You have the left-wing parties, Avodah and Meretz. You have to close to get some kind of agreements with Ram. You need to check that everyone from the right-wing parties, like Eilat Shaked, is on board. And no one is fleeting away like Amichai Shikli did last week. So it's a complicated issue. But from my best knowledge, to the time we are recording this podcast, they are advancing very quickly. Maybe if you're optimistic, depends on your political views, it will be finalized this week. Maybe even at Wednesday, it will be a new government. If not, we're speaking about the upcoming week. There is a problem with Eilat Shaked, and there's a huge problem with Merav Michaeli and the Labour Party. But I think it's doable. You know, everyone understands what's in stake. So maybe it will be very, very fast.
What's at stake is the possibility of a fifth election, right?
What's in stake is the possibility that Yemina will fall apart, that Tikva Chadasha will fall apart, and Netanyahu will succeed, and I mean succeed, is advancing towards fifth elections. This is his main goal. And he will stay in office for another half a year. Dysfunction government will continue for another half a year. It will be a fifth election. Maybe Netanyahu will get his magical 61 right-wing coalition. Maybe not. And if he will not get his magical 61, we are back at the same point exactly. So what is the point to go to the fifth elections? I don't understand Merav Michaeli's behavior. The Israeli left is falling apart. This is the fact. It will not be a prime minister from the deep left in the upcoming years because this is the political situation in Israel. If you want to be a part of a government, you need to compromise. If you don't want to be a part of a government, so just wait in the line and have another elections after another elections after another elections. And in the end, will be extreme right-wing government. We're not able to do anything against it. So
what kind of coalition are they working? Are they working to find as broad a coalition as possible?
Look, it's going to be a very weird government because it will include many, many, many parties with huge ideological differences, with a very thin majority, if at all, because this majority depends on the Arabs, a little bit from Ram, and maybe a little bit of Tibi, etc. And they have a very different point of view on the Israeli politics. So it's going to be a very huge coalition. You know, in general, we say that in Israel, to govern, you need a very strong political power. And no one has this strong political power inside this weird coalition. So it will need to rely on good faith. In general, in good faith doesn't work in politics.
Especially in Israeli politics.
Yeah, in Israeli politics. It's going to be a miracle. Governing with good faith. And governing without trying to score cheap political points on your friends, rivals inside the government, but on really goodwill. It's going to be a very interesting experiment in political psychology. I don't know how it will work, but until now they're having this goodwill, so let's see.
The coalition guidelines, which presumably they're trying to work out all the time, it's going to be the smallest document in political history, right? The only thing pretty much that they can agree on is that they don't want Netanyahu as prime minister.
Look, the political guidelines is a piece of garbage, but you know, what is not important what to say on day one. It's what important is what will come during your marriage, because you cannot maybe you can forecast a little bit what will happen, but you don't know what will happen. Maybe it will be war, maybe it will be peace. The opposition have their stunts in order to embarrass the coalition. Let's say putting forward some laws that some of the coalition agree and some of the coalition don't agree. You have civil issues, you have diplomatic issues, you have many, many issues that will be huge, complicated. They say from the beginning, we understand that we're in a status quo government. We cannot do big stuff because it's doubtable. Mm. We need to do small changes at a time, and mainly to change the political environment from this Netanyahu cult that started here in the last few years. So, by the way, it would be interesting how to see a political system without Netanyahu.
Many people can't even remember that far back what it's like, the political landscape without Netanyahu in some form.
I do remember, but also it's Netanyahu will not be will go away because he will be stay the head of the opposition. He needs the immunity because of his trial, but I don't think he will leave the political system. But you know, I don't know, maybe he will lose power inside the Likud. Is the Likud is going to stay this cult party of Netanyahu, and if you're trying to raise your head against them, you're kicked out, or it will change again and maybe grow and maybe shrink.
Haven't the potential defectors already left the Likud and formed their own new parties?
Saar left the Likud. Mm-hmm. Kahlon left the Likud. Lieberman was kind of joint. By the way, Lieberman left the Likud in the 90s to form his party in 99, but he still ran together with the Likud in 2013. Mm. Gilad Ardan, decided not to leave the Likud to form a new party, but ran away to Washington. I doubted that he voted Likud, etc., etc. So it would be interesting. Maybe the Likud will grow if Netanyahu will lose. I don't know.
Mm. So you talked about goodwill. How's the personal chemistry between Lapid and Bennett? Do they get along? Do their spouses get along?
I don't know about the spouses, I must say.
Well, that's a pertinent question in Israeli politics these days, no?
Look, I think Bennett and Lapid are just normal people. And also, I think their spouses are just normal people. With advantages and disadvantages, I don't think not Bennett and not Lapid has this messianic approach towards Israel like Netanyahu has, that if he will not be here, will be eliminated by Iran. And I don't think they have this this cult of personality around them, that they choose people according to they willing to flatter them and not according to their abilities. So it will be, I think they can go along each other, but still, the problem, it's not a problem, but they're coming from a very different positions and a very different ideologies. They can be very good friends, but in the end, it's politics. And maybe in the end, some of them will need to do a political calculation that make this government collapse. But let's see, this government will be formed.
Right, I mean, that was going to be my next question. How long can a government of this kind, when one of its heads is a center-left avowed secularist who says that the Palestinians should get a state, and the other is from the religious hard right who wants to annex most of the West Bank, how long can that marriage stay together?
Look, it would be very interesting. It's very hard to predict. I assume first crisis will be the most important crisis to see if they're able to pass in a crisis. So maybe if you love this government, you have a sense of optimism that they can survive for 4 years. Lapid has the incentive to survive for 4 years because he's the second one in the rotation. So he needs to wait 2 years in order to become a prime minister. Bennett, I think, also has a very huge incentive to stay prime minister for 2 years and not. And let's say if this government is collapsing in a month or 2 months, so Bennett is a dead man politically because, he went to this huge, huge, huge shift. In the end, his government succeeded for 1 month. So I don't think he have any home to go back. So maybe.
There was a poll published on Friday by N12 television that found that 40% of Israelis support the formation of a Lapid-Bennett-led government, and that among people who describe themselves as leftists, 77% support. Mm-hmm. Does that surprise you?
No. It surprised me that it's a 77. I thought it would be 90%. I think people didn't understand the question. Like, you have these complicated polls.
You would have thought that more leftists would support
Netanyahu,
anyone but Bibi, just get rid of Bibi?
Just get rid of Bibi. Yeah. Anyone, just get rid of him.
So that poll also found that if there were direct elections for prime minister today, 2 in every 5 Israelis would vote for Netanyahu. What's happening with that proposal for direct elections. Is that was that dead in the water?
I don't believe you're asking me about this. Seriously, it's just the most stupid spin, political spin I ever saw. It was just a waste of time to discuss it. Netanyahu doesn't want it, by the way, because you're taking a huge risk. Let's say like this. The right-wing majority in the parliament is based on that the percentage of the Arab voters who are going out to vote is very low. And the political participation of the Arabs inside of the parliamentarian system is low because you can see the situation right now. They are not considerable equal party to govern. And in a direct elections, you're taking the risk that the Arab voters will go in a huge numbers out. And every vote is a vote. It doesn't matter if it's an Arab vote or Jewish vote. In the parliament, it's do matter. So I don't think Netanyahu will take this risk. It's just a cheap stunt. I don't believe anyone is discussing it. It's just a waste of time.
So is he nonetheless working behind the scenes to try and thwart the formation of a new government and to drag us to a fifth election?
Netanyahu's strategy is very clear. Putting huge pressure on right-wing members of this upcoming coalition that is going to supposedly they're going to destroy Israel if they will agree to this coalition, in order for them to break and say they will not support it, and this will drag Israel to the fifth elections. That will be, we're starting to go deep inside October, and you know, meanwhile he's in power. So and up to October we'll find a solution, and if we will not succeed in October again, what will change in this fifth elections? Maybe 50% will get to 61 and 50% will not get in 61, but he's still in power. So it will be another elections from an point of view. So why not?
Chaim, before I let you get on with your day, yeah. If you had to stake your mortgage on it, who would you back to be Israel's next prime minister? Is it Bennett all the way and possibly by the end of this week?
I think Bennett will be the prime minister. I don't know if this week, but next Monday.
Well,
even on Wednesday. By the way, someone is texting me right now. Maybe even on Wednesday.
Listener, Chaim Levinson is the only person who's allowed to check his cell phone during the recordings of this podcast.
No, I need information, you know. It's up to date.
Chaim,
it's the hardest podcast in town.
Chaim, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Simon.
Listener, do stay with us. Judy Maltz will be here after this jingle to talk to us about the planned deportation of the black Hebrew Israelites. Joining me now in the studio, I'm delighted to welcome back Judy Maltz. How's it going, Judy?
Everything's good. How are you, Simon?
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. So, listen, Judy, there's one important story that got rather lost in the past few days, perhaps understandably so, given the Mount Meron tragedy and the political upheavals. It concerns the black Hebrew Israelites and a rather sudden and seemingly arbitrary decision by Israel to expel them. First things first, though, who are the black Hebrew Israelites? How did they end up in Israel?
Okay, the black Hebrew Israelites, more commonly known as the black Hebrews or the Hebrews, first started coming to Israel in the late 1960s. They used to be called a sect or a cult. We don't use that term anymore. They were formed in Chicago. Their leader was a guy named Benamy Carter, who brought about 30 members of this group who considered themselves descendants of the tribe of Judah. They don't describe themselves as Jewish, but rather descendants of the Judah tribe. And you'll see many of them have the last name Ben Yehuda, Ben Judah. So they start coming in the late 60s, early 70s, initially on the law of return. They were allowed into the country until one day the government said, wait, hold on, these people aren't exactly Jewish, and then stripped them of their citizenship. And they were living here for many years in Dimona. That's where most of them are based, although they've spread out a little down in the Negev. So for many years, they were living here. Some were deported, but most stayed. And they were living here without any rights whatsoever. They couldn't work. They weren't eligible for health care or anything. In the 90s, the government did allow them to start working, so at least they could make some money and
with residency permits rather than citizenship.
That came later. That came in 2003. The vast majority of them that year were given residency. And since then, there have been about 100 who actually have Israeli citizenship. And this was part of a deal struck between the organization and the Interior Ministry, under which members of this community whose children had served in the Israeli army, and most of their children do, would be eligible. Mm. Once their children were released from the army, they would be eligible for citizenship. And I just want to correct one thing you said, Simon. They're not all being expelled. It's a very, very small group. There are somewhere an estimated 2,500 to 3,000 who live in Israel. Of them, there are about 100 who are, some have already received letters ordering them to leave within 60 days. It's estimated that there are about 100 undocumented Black Hebrews who have no status. And these are the ones who are being targeted. The Israeli Ministry of Interior says that all of them do hold U.S. citizenship. So they do have where to go.
Mm. You mentioned that some serve in the IDF. They do so because they are citizens and they're drafted, or do they volunteer?
They are required to, Simon. Anyone who is a permanent resident of Israel is required to serve in the army, so they are required to.
Mm. Perhaps the most famous member of that community, apart from the founder, Ben Ami Ben Israel, is Eddie Butler, the singer who twice represented Israel at the Eurovision Song Contest. Why now?
So that's a really good question. Why now? I mean, there are about 100,000 undocumented people in Israel. Why go for this small group of 100 Black Hebrews? It's not exactly clear. I was down in Dimona 2 weeks ago, and I spoke to some of the leaders of the community. And one of the things they speculated was that perhaps because now, at the time, we still had a caretaker government. There wasn't a government. As part of the coalition talks, this was something that maybe because the ultra-Orthodox have never recognized these Black Hebrews and don't like having them here, perhaps it came up in the coalition talks that, okay, this is one of the things you can get. Come in the government and, you know, we'll get rid of the Black Hebrews. I'm not so sure that's what happened. Another speculation was that, you know, they live a very kind of holistic lifestyle. Mm. They're all vegan. They don't smoke, they don't drink, but they also avoid modern medicine. And as part of their beliefs, they do not vaccinate themselves. Mm. And they are not vaccinating themselves against corona. Someone said maybe this was, you know, an excuse to let's get them out of here. It could also be that it was just coincidental. They had these 100 undocumented members of the community had applied for permanent residency. And now they're whoever the bureaucrats at the Interior Ministry finally got around to processing the applications and giving them an answer.
Mm. Is there any sense amongst the how should we refer to them? The Black
Israelites? We can call them Black Hebrews. Hebrew Israelites? Hebrews? Hebrew Israelites?
Amongst this group,
yeah.
Is there any sense that this is another sign of growing intolerance in Israel to the other?
Well, those who have been targeted in this move by the Interior Ministry do feel that that is the case. But, you know, there's still a bit of time. They have 21 days to appeal this decision. They are definitely going to appeal it. Mm. There seems to be a lot of sympathy in the country for their cause. Many of the younger members of the community started a Facebook campaign in which they had pictures taken of themselves in their army uniforms with holding signs saying, "We too are Hebrew Israelites." And of course, you know, everyone in Israel is very sympathetic to anyone who has served in the army. So there is a lot of sympathy. Looks like we're going to have, maybe there's a chance now we're going to have a new and different government, which might be more tolerant of so-called others. Mm. So
we don't like to tempt fate on this podcast,
right,
Judy.
Right.
There was supposed to be a demonstration last week, right, that was postponed because of the Meron tragedy. And does there seem to be much support for their cause amongst the general Israeli public?
I think there's a lot of support for their cause. Interestingly, the day I was down there, the deputy police minister was there. He's a member of Likud, and he is an Ethiopian Israeli. So the Ethiopian Jews who live in this country do feel a lot of affinity with them. And it was not a coincidence that this particular deputy ministry met with them, and he said he was going to advocate on their behalf.
Mm. So your report on this story was one of the most commented on articles on the website recently. Someone posted a response to your the report saying that maybe if the black Hebrews undergo religious conversion supervised by Israeli approved rabbis, as well as submit to skin lightening procedures, their case may be reconsidered. That's obviously a very cynical view, but Israel does have something of a reputation for mistreating people of color, whether it's African migrant workers, asylum seekers, or even Ethiopian Jews, right?
Right. And there's also the case of the Abu Yadaya. That's a group in Uganda that we've reported on a lot in recent years. They are one of these emerging Jewish communities, not originally Jewish, but they embraced Judaism about 100 years ago and were formally converted about 20 years ago, mainly by conservative rabbis. And Israel has been giving them such a hard time. It's not even that they want to make aliyah. All they want to do is come visit, come on birthright, come study in Israel. And Israel has been giving them such a hard time just getting, you know, short-term visas to enter the country. And many say it's not coincidental and that it does have to do with the color of their skin and the fact that it was a conservative conversion, which the rabbinate doesn't recognize.
Mm. I mean, maybe that's the difference in Israeli officialdom's eyes between, say, the black Hebrew Israelites and the Bnei Menashe or Bnei Israel.
Yeah, well, the Bnei Menashe is a completely different case. Yes, they are also people of color, but they have the endorsement of the rabbinate, and they therefore have the endorsement of the government. And the government has allowed thousands of them to come to Israel in recent years, and there are hundreds more expected this year. So it's proof maybe that the issue isn't so much skin color as it is denominational affiliation or lack thereof.
Mm. There are plenty of non-Jewish communities in Israel that have full rights here, some even citizenship, the Baha'i, the Samaritans. What makes this group different? Is it perhaps their lifestyle that seems they practice polygamy, right?
I asked them about that when I was down there, and they said they haven't been practicing polygamy for about 15 years, although it's been grandfathered in. So there are many men there who have many wives and many children from different wives, but they said they do not practice that any longer. Yeah, it's a combination of all these things. What I learned, which was very interesting, they do keep Shabbat, but in a very different way than most Jews do.
Hmm.
They fast on Shabbat. They cleanse their bodies on Shabbat. It's a day of rest, but it's a day of cleansing and they don't eat. And as you know, food on Shabbat, I mean, what could be more Jewish than that? So
even if they're not Jews, Judy, should they be allowed to stay?
Of course. Of course. They make a wonderful contribution to the country. You mentioned Eurovision before. They are very talented. They contribute. They work. They go to the army. And, you know, once everything is reopened in this country, I would strongly recommend to go down to Dimona and visit them. They've got, it wasn't open when I was there, but they have this great vegan restaurant. Apparently, the vegan ice cream they make down there is the best in Israel. And it's just a really charming little place.
Judy, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much. We look forward to updates on that and many other stories.
Great. Always happy to be here, Simon.
Listener, that's your lot for today. My thanks to Nir Hassan, Chaim Levinson, Judy Maltz, and as ever, to the very patient and lovely Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv and inshallah, Jerusalem.